pandemic got us into a reflective space and made us look inward to see what we can do for the world at large. As a self-expression coach, I became a catalyst for women and started Vani, a one-on-one coaching program for women on finding their voice, to speak up, to be visible. As a storyteller, I spotted there were many ordinary people amongst us leading extraordinary lives, making a difference to the world, and they needed to be heard. Thus was born You and I with Rashmi Shetty, where amazing personal journeys with their uniqueness and individuality are showcased. A reaffirmation of the fact, open your eyes wider, the world is far more beautiful when we acknowledge the presence of both you and I. Our guest today is Srimati T.K. Anuradha, a distinguished scientist and a retired director, SATCOM program ISRO headquarters. Amongst the many roles at ISRO, she led the satellite-based communication program for planning, policy implementations, orbital spectral asset management from 2018 to 2020. She also led the GEO platform satellite program of ISRO as program director, consisting of communication, navigation, and Earth observation satellites from 2016 to 2018. She led the teams as project director for the successful realization and launch of GSAT-12 in 2011 and GSAT-10 in 2012 as the first woman project director from the ISRO Satellite Center. Some of the awards she received were Honorary Doctorate by Akka Mahadevi University, Vijayapura in 2018, the Woman Achiever in Aerospace 2019 by Aero India, and ISRO Performer Excellence Award in 2019. She has publications in many national and international forums. Listen in as Anuradha Ma'am carries her accolades so lightly, shares her journey with ISRO with a childlike enthusiasm, clearly showing us where passion can lead anyone. Anuradha Ma'am, welcome to You and I with Rashmi Shetty. I'm super excited.
Thank you, Rashmi. It's my pleasure.
You know, when I heard you talk, you came across as somebody who's very strict, very clear what you want to say, what you want in life, and how life has also showed whatever it can give you. As a little girl, were you a very fun-loving, friendly, carefree young girl? Because I'm curious now to know what little Anuradha was like to the space scientist Anuradha that the world sees you today as.
Rashmi, I always felt I was fun-loving, and somehow even my colleagues feel that I look strict until such a time they come to know me. Probably it's my demeanor or whatever, it looks strict, but I'm really not. And I am fun-loving. I was so even when I was young. And for a youngster, being strict, you can call it as, I translate it as studious. Yes, I was. I was very studious. And most of my activities, extracurricular activities, are also mostly studious type, like debates, essays, and talks, and science talks, and those kind of things. I was not a big, big into sports or something like that. And I used to participate in dramas, but never in music or dance or things like that. So people would call me, studious. And I was like that. But generally, I was a leader from younger days, wherever I was. If I look back now, the way I could pull in the groups to play something as kids, all that. So it was already there in me. Probably because my next sister was just 1.5 years old. So by birth, I felt I'm a leader. And I was doing that role everywhere. So that's how it was. And but I was studious when I was young.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So studious, you said, so automatically a very responsible student. Did that also automatically make you teacher's pet?
Always.
Okay. And is it because everyone who was good in studies moved towards or leaned towards science that you two went towards science, or was science a subject that fascinated you right from the time you're a little girl?
Oh, no, nothing like that. Actually, I was fascinated by all subjects except history and wherever I had to remember things. I was a great fan of literature also. Mm. I loved literature. And there was one time in high school, I was seriously contemplating whether I should pursue literature, and especially in Sanskrit. I was thinking about it. And having come from vernacular school, I just had a good English to converse or what is required for exams, not on a literary term or something like that. So definitely Kannada and Sanskrit, I was very good at, and I had a good hold on it. And I was thinking that I should pursue Sanskrit because I was very impressed with all the Kalidasa's, Bhasa, all those things when I read. It was fantastic. But my love for science and maths was also same, very much into that. And probably as I grew up, my inclination went more towards science, especially towards physics and mathematics. And that, tuned me further to become an engineer rather than as a pure scientist. I preferred that I get into applications. That's how I went into engineering also.
Yeah. Okay. So was your entire childhood in Bangalore itself?
Oh, no. I was in Shimoga from my first standard to sixth standard. Mm-hmm. So I was there in a school in Shimoga, and my father had transferable jobs. So he was a Sanskrit professor, and he was in Shimoga initially. He used to have a lot of transfers. So when he got a transfer to Bangalore, we moved. Mm-hmm. And further, we did not move for the sake of education of children. We stayed back, but he used to go around. So my initial schooling was in Shimoga.
Mm-hmm. Very much. Okay. So having a father who was so deep into Sanskrit, I loved how you split Udare Datmanatmanam yesterday. And you said it so beautifully in your talk, how you brought it out. Did you pursue your interest in Sanskrit post-school too, into
yes.
your own bit of reading and studying, not as in literature?
I did that because my father was the biggest motivation for me. And I also did exams like till COVID, where I had an opportunity to look into literature a little more, along with the grammar, etc. But later on, I did pursue even during my engineering. But later on, after I took up a profession, it went to a kind of background. And now after retirement, I'm trying to relook into it. Yes.
Okay. In this talk, when I heard you give the verse from the Bhagavad Gita, this was a question that I was tempted to ask. Has the Gita been a book which is your go-to? Because personally, for me, that's one of my favorite life manuals, a book that I go to when I'm doubtful of what to do or take my next step in. Was Gita specifically a book, or generally that you had certain books in Sanskrit that you referred to, or it was just one of the things about Sanskrit language that drew you to the language itself and not any book in specific order?
No, it was Sanskrit language itself, the beauty of the language. And as I understood the literature inside that, it's so beautiful. Even Ramayana, as a literature you read, the each verse is made so beautifully, and the right kind of words they use. There are, if you know Amarakosha, if you're aware of it, it's a Sanskrit dictionary, basically. Yeah. So you get for any word, many alternatives. And how beautifully they will be chosen into literature, it always appealed to me that was there. And I'm not a very religious person by nature. In the sense, you know, I draw a line between religion and spirituality. And I am a spiritual person. I want to be a good person. And of course, by practice, by birth, whatever we are doing, lighting the lamp in front of the God, I do it. And that is more to invoke my inner energy out. Some few minutes of being with myself. I believe that's what even Bhagavad Gita says. So each one of us have that Paramatma in us as part of us. And that's what I would like to call out, you know, more than any particular idol or, the practices and all that. I'm not much into that.
Interesting. Because this is where I want to take you back to college. Now, you said you did engineering. So which branch of engineering and where did you study? And then on, how did life decide its course for you?
Yeah, as I told, I was quite a studious student and I had very good percentage. And those days, getting a seat in government college was very meritorious.
Yeah.
So nowadays, there are so many good private engineering colleges. Those days, University Visveshwaraya College of Engineering in Bangalore, UVC, was one of the top colleges as far as the university. And easily I got into it, I had no doubt. And I got electronics. That was my subject of choice also. So I studied electronics and I fell in love with my subject there too. It was a kind of a fascination of understanding the physics and electronics is basically physics when you go into it and application goes as electronics. So it was something awesome for me. Mm-hmm. And we also made a great study circle. You know, you don't believe, I don't know how many of the youngsters try to do it. And again, that can be attributed because some of us were really studious. So we made study circle and we used to study from various books which are not necessarily prescribed for us and try to reach out to people who were there in Indian Institute of Science or somewhere else and get to know more about it. And these kind of things we were doing. And in fact, even when those days when we were there, we did not even have microprocessors as a part of our syllabus. But we chose a project which was on microprocessor base. And we had such a lovely team. We learned together and very enjoyable those days, really.
Mm-hmm.
I feel more than what we learned in the classroom, we as a team, what we learned was great. Yeah.
I think, and the study circle that you're talking about plays a very important role in making sure that what I do not know, somebody else equips themselves. And this way, the whole team benefits out of the whole study as a whole. So from the Visveshwaraya College, what was your next step after electronics engineering?
Electronics engineering, I applied for jobs and I applied for master's. Then I got into a Master of Science in Indian Institute of Science, CMS for automation. Mm-hmm. And Bangalore University exams got, you know, as usual, delayed. And by the time I went, the course had started there. Mm-hmm. And I had to wait for 6 more months to start my course. They said, just go to library and start research. At that point of time, I didn't know what research was and I didn't know what I could do. And I don't know, some kind of apathy I felt from the professors too, maybe because I'm from Bangalore University or whatever. So, and I got jobs everywhere from all public sectors. And the last one to come was ISRO. I was waiting for that. I didn't want to join any public sector. I wanted to join ISRO. I had visited as a student. So it was love at first sight for me. And I went there and I knew if I want to work, it will be the place where I want to work. The moment this one came that I am recruited there, if I have to join by that time, then I didn't make a second thought at all. So immediately I went and joined ISRO. It was like a university for me. I think I learned much more than studying anywhere in any premier school or any of those things. It's like almost immediately after my bachelor's, I joined ISRO, and nearly 38 years I served there in various roles. I enjoyed every bit of it. I think that defined who I was. Yeah.
You enjoyed yourself everywhere. From whatever you've said so far, maybe you just had the right approach to life, the right attitude to life. So whatever life gave you, you accepted it wholeheartedly and just moved on to make the most of what life was giving you. Now, ISRO is a dream place of work for anyone. Recently, when Chandrayaan happened, before that Mangalyaan, the focus was on the women and the women force in all those missions. But when you joined 38 years ago and 38 years plus, were there as many women that we see today?
No, definitely not. There were a couple of senior ladies who were engineers who had basically, I think, from Tamil Nadu and Kerala, each were there. Mm-hmm. And very senior ladies. I didn't see them in the mainstream. They were there, and probably just after I joined, they also left for various reasons. So probably they were doing a good job, but there were just a couple of them. And when we joined, we were 7-8 of us joined at a time there in various positions. And for us, it was like a college life, and it started, and we were ready to do anything, any work, and we had no inhibitions. At least I did not have any inhibition. So in fact, those days, many of the divisions, they were not ready to accept ladies, because the kind of work in ISRO is very intense. You cannot stick yourself to 9-to-5 kind of job is not the thing. So many of them would feel that girls will not be able to do, they may not stay back, and they may not be able to come on holidays and work, etc. But my boss, I really thank him. He never had any of those discriminations. Who is good, he will take. That's all. And he will assign the job, whether it is a man or a woman. I really appreciated it. I mean, I did not want to feel any kind of such feeling from others. That if I have a feeling, I'll manage it. I don't want others to have it towards me. So especially my boss, and he was like that. And I really liked that there was no discrimination, whether it is giving a banging or, giving a reward from him. He was absolutely carefree. So that's how I could bloom there. And I showed, it was like a challenge. I had to show myself. I always had a very supportive family. When I joined, I was not married. My parents were always into that you have to excel in whatever you do. My father used to quote, if you're a cobbler, you'll be the best cobbler. Do whatever you do, but you have to, that kind of atmosphere in which we grew in. I wanted to give my best. And we started staying back, and I used to stay back a lot, and we used to have two shifts. So I used to go by first shift and come back by second shift. So those extra hours and learning, those days we did not have those 3 months, 6 months orientation programs, nothing. We were just taken, dropped into the ocean, asked to learn swimming. So, that was a great way of doing it. And there again, I made a team that we wanted to see the entirety, because there was no orientation course. We were always there in our own group, but we wanted to see what it is. So some 3-4 of us, we would go in the lunchtime and visit every lab and see what they are doing and how do we fit into the entirety. We used to learn those things, and it was wonderful. It was nothing as a part of syllabus, but we did on our own. So that means much more, and you can learn more that way. And fortunately, I was put into a group where we had to do the testing of the satellite, integrated satellite. And to do the testing, we had to make our own systems, electronic systems, and we had to put our own interfaces, protections, and we had to develop our own test plans. End to end, we had to do those things. So it gave an opportunity. You had to learn about the satellites. You had to learn about the system, what you're going to test. So it gave a beautiful window of opportunity to me that I could learn about the systems. And it went on that way, and it gets noticed, you know, if you have extra initiative and you're interested, it gets noticed, and the visibility automatically happens when you take that extra step. So I think it was a very natural, organic growth for me with my enthusiasm and my need to learn and need to do new things. So that got a good opportunity in my office. You know, that's an office where you can grow beautifully. You invest and you always get back as much as you want. I am always thankful to ISRO for that.
This is so nice to hear, ma'am, but because a lot of people, especially 38 years ago, it's not very common to see women in engineering setups. Like that famous story of Sudhamurthy writing a letter to J.R.D. Tata to get women on the floor. That way, 38 years ago, when you entered ISRO, you said there were a few women before you and about 7-8 in your batch. When you saw yourself less in number there, did that inhibit you in any way? Or it made you want to prove that you're as...
No. Never I had to struggle to prove myself as a woman. I had to always try to prove myself as a worthy candidate, not as a woman, because they were all stalwarts in ISRO. Everybody is a stalwart. And I had to work with them and prove my mettle there, that I am no less than others, not as a woman, as any other new entrant. I had to do that. And later on also, ISRO is a high learning organization. You need to keep on learning all the time. You slack it and you are gone. And ISRO is also a place where your self-worth comes when you have responsibilities assigned to you. And responsibilities will be assigned to you if you are capable. You know, it's a kind of a positive cycle there. So I have to prove myself, I have to take responsibilities, make it happen. And, you know, then you feel your own self-worth goes up that way.
Yeah. What you're saying is very plain, simple, and straightforward. That prove yourself, it doesn't matter. Your gender doesn't matter. But there is a lot of unconscious bias and patriarchy in our society, which very naturally creeps in when we work with people. I'm not saying only men are patriarchal. Women are a lot more patriarchal than men are. Did you face any of those there? Because there are a lot of unconscious biases. Many of us are not even aware we are
biased. Yeah, it will be there, unconscious biases. But, you know, I'm a kind of a, even if there is an elephant in the room, I don't care. If I have to do something, I'll do and come out. So unconscious biases will be there, and I don't blame them for it. But I think many of those biases kind of, disappeared as they saw me and, you know, getting into this, and there's nothing wrong and she can also do. And many, you know, all the biases, I must tell you, in our office were more in a positive manner, in the sense being overprotective.
Okay.
That kind of thing, which I had to show that I don't need any protection. Okay. I can manage myself. And, you know, if I'm carrying some instrument from one table to other table, somebody comes to help. Said, no, sorry, I can do it myself. You know, it's more like patronizing, you know. So that kind of biases were there. And at least I could perceive that if there is anything else, I am the kind, I don't care. Because the world is made up of all kinds of people. And I am unique and I want to be who I am. So I don't care much about what others think. Yeah. And I don't do anything to impress upon others too. I don't do it. I'll never do that. Okay. If I don't like it, I won't do it. That's all.
It actually sounds very beautiful when you're saying this. And to think that years ago, even today, people feel a lot of gender bias, and inclusiveness has become a huge topic, and inclusivity is a huge topic. Talking about women as a workforce, and we are talking 38 years ago. Maybe it was the setup, the organization that
changed
the whole thing. And see, today we have the internet, we have Google for all answers for questions we had. Those times when you are new to a space learning, how were you getting the information? Was it only the library, or were you also mentored by people? Because finding the right mentors also is an important...
Yeah, true, true. As you rightly told, our main source was mentors and library. And other source was burning our fingers. Do something and it goes wrong and you understand what to do next. So that's the way we were working. And really, I had wonderful seniors who were all subject experts. And they were the first batch of people in Satellite Center who were there from the beginning. And they knew from the scratch what they had to do. And it was a great opportunity for me to work with them and learn from them directly, you know, that way. In fact, we were young. And first I was put into testing of one of the operational satellites. I did not even know many seniors at that point of time, as we were not even introduced. I was just explaining my young colleague about the satellite sensor systems, how they work and all that. And there was one elderly person. None of them were so elderly. We were around 22. They were 34, 35. And he was standing there silently, and I didn't know who he was. And I felt that domain was mine. I'm the queen, and I was operating everything. And after some time, I came to know he is the person who has designed the sensors and all that for the satellite. And he's listening to me. And then when he said, well done, right, and he added some more, and he made us understand more. I mean, that's the kind of mentorship, you know. So he would not tell, hey, wait, who are you? Let me explain. No, they would always give us chance to, you know, prove ourselves and learn by ourselves. Those are the things, wonderful time we had, really.
Even now, when you're recalling all those days and moments, you're so excited and happy. While you were there, I'm sure you were equally, if not more, excited to be on a mission every day on getting there and getting out there.
Every day morning when I woke up, it would give me a lot of energy to think that today I'm going to office, I'm going to do something. And mentally, what are the things today I'm going to do? That would motivate me to get up from bed and start my work, you know. That has been my motivation. And every single day I have enjoyed it. My workplace. And you might again say it might be your attitude, but as yesterday you told in your lecture, it is not just the attitude, it is opportunities, the preparedness, and the passion with which we do those things. That's what matters. So not that everything excited me. For example, history never excited me. So I didn't pursue much on that. For me, what has happened. Okay, now what we can do. So these things were really something very close to my heart. And probably I got guided by my inner self to do what I love to do. Always, you know. I might have avoided things which I don't like. So I don't even remember.
It was in the 80s that India's sent Rakesh Sharma also. So
he came to our office after that event.
So you must have joined ISRO in 82, right? 82, 83.
82, I remember. Yes.
80. Because for me, I still remember that amazing conversation with Mrs. Indira Gandhi. That was the first time I knew. I was, I think, about 16 or 18. And that's the first time I looked at ISRO very differently and space very differently. And I remember we all went to the terrace when they said that you can see it, not that you can see it with your naked eyes, but this is the time it would pass.
Yeah.
And the excitement in the whole country, because this Doordarshan was our means of communication and information. Since you were there at that time, can you take us through that experience of the whole project itself and then on how ISRO looked at space and space
research? I think the project had started much earlier than I joined ISRO. And he was a hero for us, and including Malhotra. I met Malhotra after several years in one of the conferences. It was great meeting with him, and same excitement and same hero worship. And we had selfies with him and all that. Yeah, and that had nothing to do with ISRO per se.
Yeah. It was particular. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It was nothing to do with ISRO, but in ISRO we were so starry-eyed that one day we are also going to do that, right? So we were in the baby steps at that time. Still, our initial operational satellites were coming up, but it was a great feat for all of us that Rakesh Sharma could go there, and you know how he conducted himself, how he managed himself. Everything was exemplary. So he even was an advisor to us when we started our human space program and all that. And and we always respect the veterans who have contributed a lot. I think the excitement was something like today's kids would have had the excitement when Chandrayaan 2 landed on the moon. Yes. So similar excitement we had when Rakesh Sharma was there in the space.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because for us on ground zero, on the other side out of ISRO, Rakesh Sharma and Ravish Malhotra were people whose names everybody knew in the country. Yes. And that conversation, like I said, which was telecast, was something that is still very, very vivid and fresh in my mind.
I think it's as beautiful as what Neil Armstrong told when he set his first foot on the moon.
Yeah.
So it's as great as that, his statement.
From there, it was a different push in the way in which the Aam Janta looked at ISRO, because that's where our dreams were now. So, okay, India was responsible in choosing one man, taking Russia's help, but India landed on the moon. It was on a space mission. And here comes Chandrayaan years later, Mangalyaan before that, and the hundreds of satellites all going simultaneously. Suddenly, ISRO had everything going its way. But from that point till this point where things were just moving fast, there was a lot of preparedness happening inside ISRO, that the excitement for everyone in India was that every small achievement was my achievement. And Sriharikota was the place where everyone would want to go see launches. So you were there in those exciting phases where ISRO was preparing for these big missions. Now it's happening back to back, but the seeds were sown way before and the planning has been happening over the years. As a scientist who was there in those important moments of growth and preparation, what has your experience been, ma'am? Because you were in that side of planning and making sure that those dreams are coming true.
My perception, let me tell you, is slightly different. It's not Rakesh Sharma's going into space which made the heads turn towards ISRO. And because even in early 80s, we had, you know, it was a, I joined at a time which was very significant time, because we had our own very small Aryabhata, Bhaskara, Rohini, which were launched at that time. And people didn't know much about it, and they were not launched from India also. We did not launch from India. Rohini, of course, later on, Rohinis were launched from Indian satellites, SLVs. So, and SLVs also had their share of failure. We had failures, and then ASLV came, and ASLV was also kind of partial success when we came. And In fact, I don't think people took us seriously at that point of time. Okay, so something is going on and we are also trying to do and that kind of thing. But in fact, that was a phase, as you rightly told, that it was a seeding phase, that a great rocketry work was going on, learning from the failures and going ahead, making big rockets. On the other side, we had learned how to make satellite systems using Aryabhata and Bhaskara and our own Rohini satellites, which are also payload for our new launchers, which were going on. And then along with that, having got the confidence in making satellite systems, we were also preparing for the operational satellites. In the sense, they were not experimental in nature, and they are meant for serious usage, serious business, that we call as operational satellites. And these serious business also, as per the dreams of Vikram Sarabhai, that it was not to go put a man into space or to touch moon or Mars. No, it was to bring all the technology for the common man for the betterment of India. That was the purpose. For that, our first operational satellite, we made remote sensing satellite IRS-1A, which took the imagery for vegetation and so many monitoring of the earth element. And we had series of satellites, including ocean monitoring and resource monitoring, etc. They were all shaping up. And I was part of those operational phase. At the same time, smaller satellites were getting ready as experiments to be put on our new rockets. I mean, in case it becomes a success, then we have an application. And if it is not a success, then we were also putting many experiments on that so that we can learn about it. So the rocketry was going high, and on-the-ground preparation to utilize those applications were also getting ready, ground stations and the required software requirements and data processing centers. They were all already doing very great. So that was the time when I joined. So it was a great time, but people didn't know still. So we had to bring in the users and show them the applications that you can benefit from this, whether it is communication or whether it is remote sensing data for agriculture or for town planning or water resources, etc. So when we were doing that and bringing the users, slowly the users woke up and they became very demanding customers to us in no time. That put us on a speed, nerve-wracking speed, really. We had to make so many satellites. Every ministry, every application wanted, satellites. Oh, well, you said you can do it. When are you giving me this satellite? So weather monitoring, whether it is weather monitoring or telecommunication, Doordarshan, this is our, for the televisions, DTH, broadcast, all these things, it just opened up. I think those were the time when ISRO was really looked at somebody who is doing something which is useful for everybody. And whether it is banking or business, anything you take it, it is so ubiquitous space in every aspect of our life. That's when it happened in 90s and early 2000. So I think that's when people started looking. And of course, the most imagination capturing event was Chandrayaan 1, I suppose. Mm-hmm. our satellite was there going around the moon. Mm-hmm. And as you told, preparation is most essential. A lot of research and a lot of hard work went in each of those streams the way we did it. And even for science missions, which are always there in the background, because we had to first meet the applications, requirements of the country. So we were doing at the background these preparations. Even human space program is not 1 or 2 years. Been working on it for 15 years. If you remember, sometime in 2007, we had, SRE, where it entered into atmosphere. And later we did how to do the nose cone and how to temperature resistant nose cone we had to provide. And so many such experiments were done. How to do the pad abort test. So in case something goes wrong, you have to eject and humans have to come out. Parachute, how to do that. All these experiments have going on, including Vyoma Mitra, you might have heard, our own human robo. So all a lot of preparation goes on. That's why there is no single day when there is no work at ISRO. We may be thinking of 20 years ahead and we have to work hard today so that after 10 years, it comes to reality. And those imaginative programs are always exciting, really.
I know. The father of Indian space research, Dr. Vikram Sarabhai's dream of making sure that it reaches common man and should be utilized for common man was a dream that many people scoffed at and laughed at, saying, how is it going to be possible? But that's what his mission was, that we are going to make the ordinary Indian understand the power of research, space especially, and satellites. So when somebody had such a clear vision, was that the reason why the entire organization had its mission clearly chalked out on how we would progress? Because India was never in a hurry to put someone up there, but India was working on a very different line of thought. And was it somewhere, ma'am, the mission statement that Dr. Sarabhai so clearly had etched out for ISRO, that was the reason why the organization followed that and had clarity in vision?
100%, no doubt about it. And, you know, if you put a good seed, you'll get a good tree out, right? So the seeds were really good. And we had an environment which was very fertile with people who are eager to work, participate, enthusiasm, passion with which, that was the environment. And it worked out so well. And it's something like a synergy. And there is no iota of doubt also that we'll be successful in doing things what we are doing. Only thing is it might take some time and some resource. You know, if you just compare to any big countries, our budget is quite small for the kind of activities we are doing. It's not just the money, I think, the budget or money. But what we have wealth is the passionate people. We are making it happen, even with the least of the budgets, and we know how to cut down, where to cut down. If you see engineers working, engineers and scientists working, such long durations in any other space agency, they will charge the agency for that, for those extra hours. I don't think any one of us do that. So we are there for the office, we are there for the missions all the time. And converting vision to mission was a kind of a engraved thing in each and everybody's mind. We had no doubt, why am I doing it? Very clear goal we had.
Because you're right. And can you recall any moment, ma'am? I'm sure there are many, but anything that's really close to your heart or any conversation that you had, anything that makes this journey of yours so very special to you, any story that you would like to share at this point of time?
Yes, Rashmi, there are plenty of them. What can I say? I mean, probably I can tell you my favorite project was technology experiment satellite, which we brought out for, to keep an eye on the Indian borders. And that was post Pokhran 2 and post Kargil. We had to do that. And that was a wonderful satellite. We brought in, I think, a couple of dozen new technologies. And, there was a ban on giving us the technology, et cetera, at that point of time. But we took it as a challenge. We brought it out, and that satellite worked so beautifully. And it paved the way for, a different class of remote sensing satellites in India. So we could go to submeter resolution in those days. We were the best in remote sensing for commercial applications in those days, So that was a very proud moment for me because I was part of that project. That was one thing. And so many things like that, you know, huge. And every project we worked on had a challenge of its own. And I worked as associate project director for navigation program. At that point of time, we brought our own indigenous navigation system. And I was part of the study of how to bring in the design concepts and all that. So that was another wonderful experience where I could learn a lot. Every time you do those things, you know, you do learn, and the constellation is there and as good as GPS for Indians, and it is meant for special applications. Of course, anybody can use, but those who have to use are using it. So that is a proud moment. And finally, there at headquarters, when for a SATCOM program, at that point of time, it was a wonderful experience. I think I cherish the duration the most. So it was like I could see the end-to-end, entire panorama of the communication in the country. And I had to be in touch with Prime Minister or ministers in charge, or here on the other side, whether a jaman or a fisherman or a businessman who is using our communication end-to-end. And some of the programs we brought in, like tele-education and telemedicine. And when we thought that now with optical fiber cables and all that, why do we need it? We can stop it. And we called all the secretaries and chiefs to talk to us whether they are using, how much they want to use. Otherwise, we can utilize that resource somewhere else. But what an overwhelming response it was. Everyone said, please don't stop it. Especially when I talked to the integrated defense services, the gentleman, he came and told the how they are using it in the remotest areas in the northeastern, Himalayan front, and how it is useful for them. I had tears in my eyes. So, I mean, it gave me a kind of, a gratification in life that in some way, I am a small bolt or nut there, but I am there serving the country in some way or the other, you know. So a lot of stories like that. I mean, maybe we had to sit for weeks together for me to tell you those stories.
And along with these stories come highlight moments that you now sit back, recollect, and in your journey, they become milestones, unforgettable moments, people you've met, recognitions you've got, and overall looking at such a decorated journey that you've had. So in your journey, what are some of those milestones and spotlight moments that you still cherish?
Yeah, because my career, I did not stay at one place of working. Mm-hmm. So in general terms, we tell us divisions, groups, projects, etc. So I felt very comfortable in a particular area. I always had a change for a higher level, and I had to handle a bigger responsibility and more to learn. So they were always there. But I think the most cherishable one was when my director called me one day and in 2008, and he told me that you are going to be the project director for a communication satellite. And that was when it was a moment for me, because it was a big responsibility. And I had worked mostly on the remote sensing side. It was the communication satellites were another area altogether. And I had always worked in smaller domains, not as a project director. A project director normally in our office is a leader who has team members who are all experts in their own fields. It's not that you are going to tell them how to do. They're all experts by themselves. And handling them is not very easy. Whether they will talk in their own jargons, there are mechanical engineers, there are many specialties they'll be working on. And he told me, come back tomorrow and tell me whether you will take it. So I didn't come back tomorrow. I told him then and there, yes, sir, I will do it. Because I said, this is a challenge for me, I'm going to do. He said, are you sure? I said, I'm very sure. You don't want to think about it. I said, no, I have thought about it. If you have confidence to offer me this post, I'm going to do that. So that was a kind of turning point in my life, I think. My judgment that I must take the challenge and do. And I know the path will not be that of roses. It's going to be a lot of hard work, I knew. And I said, yes. Without thinking or without going out of the room, I said, yes. So that was a great moment for me. See, awards, rewards and all, you leave it aside. And, you know, when you're working, I consider that they are more as a, you know, recognitions to give as an example for others than I think that it is for me or anything, because most of it is a teamwork what we do. It's more as a, you know, being a leader of a team, you will be called upon and you'll be given it. So I do not attach any great significance that I got this or that, no. And but the challenge I accepted was something great. And I had a conversation with my daughter, which I cannot forget. Already, even in my own smaller domains, it used to be a lot of work and extended hours, etc. And when I came home and told I'm accepting as a project director, first thing she said is that, does it mean you can come back home early? Then I said, it means I'm going to work more than I have to work. Then she said, what? Then are you going to get more pay? Then she said, I said, no, pay is not linked to the work. How much work I'm doing, pay is with my promotions. This is not a promotion. This is a higher responsibility of work. I'm doing that. So she was very, wonderstruck. Why am I doing this? I have to work more, no extra pay. Why are you doing it? Then I said, this is what I want to do. Tomorrow when you grow up, I want you to do what you want to do, where your heart lies, you should do it. You know, I'm happy that I could set an example to my daughters. And some of these things, you know, were really, I think, which I cannot forget, some of these moments.
And I think you've not set an example only for your daughters, but for all women who have met you. I'm sure you've kind of been the trendsetter, moving the path. And you very clearly, ma'am, established right at the beginning itself of our conversation here that any space, especially in the space that you were working in, it was gender agnostic. It was more about proving to be your best version every day when you set out your foot to the office space that you're working in. Ma'am, you just spoke about your daughter. And talking about the team back home, like you said, the family, how do you build that balance? Because for a woman, the challenge is as you're progressing in your career clock, your family also has equal responsibilities that ask for your attention. So How do you maintain that ability to be still stable, clear at your place of work and understand how much you can give yourself at home?
Very correct, Rashmi, because family is also equally important. We have to balance out the both. And I don't think there is any superwoman to do such things, you know, unless we have a good amount of help. I never hesitated asking for help anytime from anybody. And at home, we were really a team. In the sense, I had a joint family and my parents-in-law were there with me. And for a long time, my brother-in-law, sister-in-law, it was a full house which was there. And the home from which I came before marriage was also like that, always a full house. And, you know, everything, guests would be coming and things have to be going on. And here too, and it's not that because I had all of them around, I could leave the family and do the office work. We have to be there for each other. That's very important, emotionally, financially, and even physically help any required. We have to equally participate and do. And that kind of wonderful family setup I had, that we were there for each other anytime. And when I
when I am happy, the family was happy with me. Yeah. So why would they not be? If I'm happy, I can spread happiness in the family too. My daughters would be happy. My in-laws would be happy. Parents would be happy. Everybody was so proud of what I was doing. And I was proud of them about what they were doing. And my husband was also in a very responsible position. He was growing up, and I am always proud of him. And he has his own set of capabilities and skills, which I lack sometimes. And I have a set of skills which he lacks. So we always, you know, complimented. And as a family, we were bringing up everything together. And that's very important when you're there, that the trust that we have with each other in the family, that's what I call as a team. A team has to have trust with each other. Yeah. So the trust was there in the family with all of us. And I don't say everybody has to follow my formula, but they have to find their own formula also. What is the best formula for them? Yeah. So because I know some of my colleagues who came from other states who did not have the luxury of the kind of family support I had, they did not have. I know this Aditya project director, Nigar Shahji, she had two kids at home, small kids, and she would leave the kids in the, you know, baby sitting place. And she would go home by 9:30, 10, and her husband was abroad for some time. And, you know, she managed. And, you know, and her children have grown to be so confident and wonderfully grown up. So how you manage family as a team is very important. Each will find their own formula if you want to do. Yeah. If the family sees that you are, you know, deriving happiness in doing something in a good way, you are not going to office to enjoy, right? They're seeing you're struggling hard and you're, you know, getting enjoyment doing that. They'll be part of you. They will support you. And so everybody has to find their formula to have a happy family network and happy family support. Because without family support, you cannot achieve. It's very true that children have to be brought up and you have to give them security. You have to make sure that their nutrition is good and that you have to make sure they have good education and they grow up to be good citizens in the society. So if I look back whether what all I did is right or wrong, on the family front, I see all proud faces and my daughters have grown up very independent and they are good citizens. They have their own strong convictions, which may not match with mine many times, but they have their convictions. I respect that. And on the office side, I have no regret that I could not take up any responsibility. Everything which was assigned to me, I have done to the best of my abilities. So that is a certification I give for myself. So I never had to reject any responsibility given to me, refuse any responsibility. So that is a certification. So I think it went well for me and it's a gratifying life. So that's why I say that it's very important teams are there. Even in office, I had my own set of team.
Yeah.
You need to vent out sometimes some pressure. Human beings will always undergo pressure. There's no person like a yogi who doesn't have any pressure in life. We'll all have pressures, office pressures, home pressures. We have it. And we also need to, you know, have good friends with you. I made friends in the office who are lifetime friends for me. They are my team. And I could easily, and they could also easily share it with among ourselves and find some solution to each other in there. Talk to a personal problem. They had become like an extended family. Wherever I worked, my teams were like that. And they're all my friends for lifetime, even today. And, you know, the moment you talk about it, the solution comes. Not because they gave a solution, your own loud thinking, what could have been done, you get a solution. You don't have to pent up everything inside your head, you know. So that kind of friends I had in the office, And wherever I went, really, I kept moving from different places. Everywhere I went, I had a wonderful team, both men and women. I had friends, both were men and women. And at equal terms, we could talk with each other. And they were also free talking to me. That way, you know, it's very important that you find your company, good company around you, and good teams. And we would stand for each other in, they were their responsibility. They were ready to things like that. You had to make it enjoyable wherever you go.
Yeah, that is true. But I think, you know, in your case, you attract it because they say your vibe attracts your tribe. And in your case, it is that energy that you carry that automatically attracts all the right people into your tribe. And that's how you are who you are. And you have found everyone who's part of that inner circle of yours.
I can't take credit to it. All of them were really great.
Today, there is a lot of conversation and they're talking about empowerment of women. Honestly, sometimes I wonder why. Why are they doing this? Because women are having education. Women are having the choices, the opportunities, and they can pick what they want. They choose when to step in, when to step out, but still the societal pressures are very automatically pointed towards women to take the back step when the choice of career versus family comes in. The natural nurturer caretaker is the woman. And that's why even today in 2024, and you started your career 38 years ago, but in 2024, we are still talking inspire inclusiveness as a Women's Day theme. What does it tell you when after so
many years? The problem is real. The problem is real. It's not whether it is 38 years or 100 years back. There was one Jhansi Rani and you know, so many queens who fought and all. But they stand as examples that women could do it. Yes. So I always say that example, you know, is an exception. They did it. So it also shows that somebody, if they want to do it, they can do it, definitely. Right. So I think I personally, or people like me who are there personally, who had a good family life where parents have instilled confidence in them. And that's what is most important, I think. So when you are a child, you know, that you can do anything, that confidence, if it is given, the children will grow up, then there will not be those baggages. But once a baggage is put, and then when you are educated, grown up, onus is on you to carry the baggage or to drop it. But many cannot drop it, unfortunately. They want to carry the baggage. And they also try to become too comfortable in the baggage, carrying the baggage. And they feel that there is a general acceptance and I'm doing it. But if they are not lying to themselves, I have no complaints if they want to do. It's all about choices in life, you know. So if you're exercising your own choice, I'm happy for that person, right? So it's not, I don't want to pull everybody, come and stay in the office, do work. No, I'm not telling that. But is it your choice, you please think? That's what I tell them. You want to do something, but you are doing something else. Then that's not a healthy society or healthy situation that's going to be. Fortunately for me, I have been brought up in a very open kind of system in our house where we could question anything. I always give that example. My father used to tell the story of Prahlad and ask us, what did you understand from that? That we should always believe in God. And you know, he says, that is all okay. No. Even if it is your father who tells and you don't agree to it, like Hiranyakashipu and Prahlad, you know, the son stood by his ground because he had a conviction. He would tell us the same thing. Wherever you are, if you have a conviction, you don't have to bow down to any authority. So that's the way, you know, that's the kind of analogies and examples, stories, morals. While he was educating us with all our Indian culture and Indianness and in our scriptures. He would also give these values to us. And, you know, that kind of questioning should be there from the childhood. So in Shumaga, where I used to study, it was a very conventional school. Mm-hmm. And there, the boys would sit in one row and the girls would sit in another, in a row of benches. And we wouldn't talk to each other. And we wouldn't address by name also. And then, but evenings when I come, I would play with boys and girls in our street with everyone. Then one day I asked my teacher, why are they sitting there and why are we sitting here? Why are we not all of us sitting hide by hide? That was the way we used to sit, no? Hide by hide. Yeah, so yeah. Why is it not made? Then she laughed and told that as if anybody will sit boy and girl together. I said, what is there? What will happen? I was in third standard. What will happen? Will you go and sit there? I said, sure, I will sit. And I went and sat with the boys. And I still remember how red the face of the boy next to me was. But I was, you know, totally perplexed. Why not sit here? Then she said, okay, you are very bold. Come back here. And then she made me sit back here, you know. And I didn't understand why they were doing. I never liked that kind of conventions. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I was young, when we had our friends, we were playing around. There was a church nearby. Then I told my friends, I used to be the leader of the gang always, come, let's go to the church next Sunday. They all go there and do something. And they were so afraid. They said, no, we should not go to church. Our parents will scold. No, we should not go. Then we came home. My younger sister was always tagging along with me. And she was still arguing with me. I will tell father if you go to church. We should not go. Then I said, I will tell him and go. I'm not afraid to go. Then he was hearing inside. He came back and told my sister, there is nothing wrong. You can go anywhere. All are same God. You know, that is the kind of atmosphere in which we grew up, you know. Mm-hmm. I think many don't have that advantage, unfortunately. Yeah. And if they don't have and they are carrying the baggage, at least I request those sisters that they give a baggage-free life to their children.
Mm-hmm.
At least now. In another 15, 20 years, we'll have youngsters who will come up with questioning and broad-mindedness and who will go forward with courage to do whatever they want to do, you know, without thinking too much of those things.
Yeah. Very beautiful, true statements, ma'am.
I think it's family which matters.
Yeah, really. It does play a big role. Now, you spoke about you being spiritual and not religious, and this Carl Sagan's beautiful quote on the pale blue dot. Since you were working in that space, and you see the expanse of what it can do when technology meets space, on that element of spirituality, did it build even further and stronger that there is a force above us that controls us? Or what were your reflections on, let's say, Carl Sagan's pale blue dot?
I am simply awed by the universe. Simply awed by the universe. And there's a lot we don't know. Compared to what we know, there is a lot more we don't know in the universe. You know, and that unknown what exists, you can call it as, you know, God or spirituality or whatever you want, because there is something unknown. When the first set of human beings, when they were there, they were afraid of everything around them.
Yeah,
they didn't know why earthquakes are happening, why heavy rains are falling, and why cyclones are there. They didn't know, and they started worshipping everything. You know, their fear converted into worshipping. And humans have evolved since then. From worshipping, they have gone into curiosity to understand what is it. And then they have gone further how to harness it for their own use, right? I don't say I'm very evolved or anything, but if an evolved person is there, that is the cycle one would take. From fear to worship to curiosity to, you know, understanding and be one with it, right? So yeah. you yeah. can call by any name. I think I'm in a curiosity stage.
And talking about curiosity and the unknown, all of us were hit by the pandemic a couple of years ago, and the whole world came to a standstill. Everyone's race paused, and everyone got off the treadmill, decided, okay, let's see what life is like. And nature clearly showed us who's the boss.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And for somebody like you, who are so much into science, technology, and space, and being awed by the unknown, how and what did the pandemic teach you? And what are your reflections from the pandemic, ma'am?
See, one thing I learned was that I'm a very extrovert. I like people. I like to meet people. I want to be amidst people. But definitely, I learned how to be with myself during pandemic. And I enjoyed it too. I really enjoyed it. And I'm confident today that I can make myself happy and I can be happy by myself sitting anywhere. And there are a lot of things you can do by yourself. And it doesn't affect me much that I don't meet people for a month or so. It doesn't affect me at all. So that's the learning aspect of it. But definitely, as you told, whatever is science and technology which has gone, what happened in the early 20th century repeats in the early 21st century again.
Yeah.
And we are all hit by the same, you know, kind of agony and pain and deaths that happened. So whatever we learn is not sufficient at all.
Mm.
And, you know, it's beyond anything. And it's humans, we are the gods and we are the destroyers, definitely. we can create any kind of havoc and destroy ourselves. So at least we knew why it happened and how it spread, you know, that knowledge exists. So it makes you look at humanity in a different perspective. We are not all pervasive gods. Definitely, we are also the destroyers. On and often, humans have proved that. And again, the same proof comes.
Very true. And we are at the last part of the conversation where I'd love you to share three life lessons of yours in this amazing life that you have led so far.
I can only say that we have to put heart and soul into whatever we do. They get everything they desired for. And probably it is not just the luck, as you told us the day, their preparedness and opportunities, the way they picked it, whatever. So they are fortunate that it happened that way. But if you happen to pick something because which is beyond your control, I think we cannot waste our life, and we need to love and make the best of what is there. That is most, most important. I'm not going to sit and cry on something that I didn't get what I wanted, you know. So I will definitely make everything beautiful around me. I want everybody to make their surroundings beautiful, you know, spread happiness. And that's the way you get motivated and you can do great things too. I mean, what if it is in your hand, you will definitely do. If it's not in your hand, you have to accept sometimes. Not accepting is not going to help in life. You have to accept and move on and try to love what you got. If you can't get what you loved, at least love what you got. So it's something which everybody should know to be happy. And as far as a profession is concerned, you have to treat it like God. You treat God. Your workplace should be your temple. And you have to give your best there. It's for your own sake, not for the organization, for your own sake. Otherwise, you are going to be unhappy. If you don't give your best, you're going to be unhappy. You have to give your best. You have entered there with all understanding of what is your salary, what are your perks. You have understood that. And once you had joined, you cannot go on negotiating with that. Yeah. And you had to give your best. For professionals, that's what I say. In fact, I've told many people, youngsters, and when they came and said, why should I do this or that? No, you don't have to do it all. Please go home. There are a lot of opportunities for you outside. Why are you here? You write down in a book and a sheet of paper. If you're so unhappy, write down why you are still here. Either you are incapable of getting something else outside. What is it? What is the reason you are not gone? Or there are points which you really love here, and that's why you are here. Write it down and list which is bigger. They have always come back and told me, thanks, I was a little disturbed, I'm all settled down now. You know, so don't do what you don't want to do. Nobody will force you. Who will force? If you go, organization will take somebody else. So we are all disposable. So to make ourselves indisposable, which will put in a lot of, you know, quality in our life, we have to contribute. That's what matters. Simple. If we follow that, no big thing is required. Try to be happy and give your best, whether it is home or office. You do that to best ability. And it works out. I suppose it works out for everybody.
Yeah, it definitely does. And like you said, it's a choice. From whatever you spoke all along, ma'am, that is one thing that was very clear, that it was your choice on doing what you were doing. And whatever came, you took it up and you took it to the next level of satisfaction. Because in life, definitely, we regret what we did not do. We never regret what we did because we've learned something and moved forward.
Yes.
What an amazing story. Thank you so much, ma'am. Honored to have had you on You and I with Rashmi Shetty. It was a pleasure meeting you. And I didn't even think that we'd have this conversation on the podcast so early. So I'm really excited that you agreed to be on it. And what a conversation. God bless you. Continue to inspire everyone you meet. You're exceptional and wonderful. Stay blessed, ma'am.
Thank you, Rashmi. I enjoyed talking to you, really.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
With that, we come to the end of this weekly quest of You and I with Rashmi Shetty. Do let us know if you know people who make the world beautiful. Write in to rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. That is rashmi.thethirdeye@gmail.com. Come, let's explore this amazing world together, both you and I.